to the history of the Nipulus Florum, while also bringing the Florilegium more fully into the realm of the Reformation and confessional debate. In publishing a revised version of Thomas of Ireland's text from his press in Geneva, Jakob Stohr provided Calvinist ministers with a handy database of authorities to employ in their pastoral work and in their debates with Catholics. And though relevant to Calvinists in general, many parts of Stohr's text seem especially suited to the situation of Huguenots in France. This suitability is seen throughout Stohr's text, and a prime example of this is in the Lemma Ecclesia. In Ecclesia, the net result of Stohr's editorial work is a group of quotations that reflects both the particular perspective of French Calvinists and how they conceived of themselves, and also the shared intellectual world that existed at the time, which transcended confessional differences. Jakob Stohr first published his version of the Nipulus Florum in 1593, and I think this is actually a title page from the 1596 printing, but I think it's the same edition, just a different print run, and the page numbers match up and everything. So he printed his first version, his first edition in 1593, and it included many changes from a 1567 edition printed in Lyon, which served as his proximate source. And these changes included quotations that were added and removed, new authors employed, and three new topic chapters added. He transmitted large parts of the text untouched, but his editorial work meant that some sections were significantly changed. The Stohr's version went through many print runs even after his death, shows that there was a sustained market for the text. It also provoked a Catholic response, both by being put on the Index of Prohibited Books and through a Catholic version of the Nipulus Florum printed in Cologne, whose preface denounced the version coming out of Geneva as expressing not Thomas of Ireland's spirit, but Calvin's, and as containing not flowers, but poison. Thinking just about this latter response, which was first printed in 1606 by the publisher Bernhard Wolter, it shows broadly how Stohr's version became entangled in Reformation-era debates. And it also points more specifically to some of the most relevant lemmata for this confessional engagement, since Wolter lists the most offensive ones according to his reading. These lemmata, being some of the most heavily edited and controversial ones, reveal many aspects of his editorial agency, and perhaps are also the ones that were most useful to Calvinist ministers. And while all of the lemmata that Wolter mentioned are identified are mentioned here, the focus will be on Ecclesia. The others that Wolter mentioned were Antichristus, Confessio, Eucharistia, and Maria. Ecclesia is of interest because, on the one hand, defining the true church was a central concern of all confessions during the 16th and 17th centuries, and hence a useful place to look at how Stohr was engaging with such debates. And on the other hand, because the single topic displays clearly Stohr's editorial hand and his relationship with the history of the Nipulus Forum. As a result, a reading of Ecclesia provides a valuable and telling glimpse into Stohr's version of the Nipulus Forum, showing how important sections of it were transformed to reflect a Calvinist position. However, as a sort of synecdoche of confessional debates more broadly, Stohr's Nipulus Forum and its version of Ecclesia also show how, along with these divisive points of doctrinal difference, there is also a large body of ideological similarity, whether in the form of beliefs, systems of morality, or the authorities that supported them. So although a history of the Nipulus Florum up to Stohr's version is not necessary here, it is important to look more closely at his proximate source, an edition amended and published by Thibaut Payen in 1567 in Lyon. And also look at Stohr's own professional history. Doing this will properly contextualize both the physical text and Stohr's approach to the Nipulus as an editor and publisher. And I refer here to Stohr as the publisher, or as the editor, because he regularly had an active editorial hand in many of his publications. And in his preface, he says that, although he says that he had the help of a learned friend in making the editions, he doesn't name that individual by name, or he doesn't identify that person by name. And so I just use Stohr as shorthand for the editor of this text, whether or not it was him on his own or he had the help of other people. Anyway, Stohr was born outside of Strasbourg in 1542, and he arrived in Geneva in 1559 and began his apprenticeship as a printer under Jean Crespin and later Jean Riveri, two important individuals in the history of Calvinist printing. In 1568, he became an independent printer and a bourgeois of Geneva. And then from then until his death, he remained an active participant in Geneva's printing industry and in the wider book trade. Storr produced a variety of publications, from legal texts and classical works to Bibles, Psalters, and contemporary religious controversies, such as monarchomach literature, which dealt with the nature of religion and politics and how they intersected, and what that meant for the French monarchy. Anyway, as a result of this type of work that he was engaged with, he worked with a number of important Calvinists, such as Theodore de Beze and Simon Goulart. In addition to his press and store in Geneva, he also had a stall at the Frankfurt Book Fair. He worked closely with booksellers in Lyon and La Rochelle, and even had links to vendors as far away as England. The Storr's publications linked him to the wider world of international Protestantism, and especially Calvinists in France, is important for understanding the history of his version of the Minipolis. But that link itself was also a very natural consequence of the nature of the Genevan printing industry more generally, an industry that was very export-oriented and was especially concerned with France. Characteristics of many of Storr's publications, the Minipolis included, also bear the marks of texts destined for the clandestine book trade in France. In addition to producing many texts of the sextdecimo size, such as this one here, which this picture is 7 years old, but I don't think my hands have shrunk or grown since then. And it, in fact, looks very similar to the Venetian version that was passed around yesterday. So it's a very small, very portable one, and this one actually included clasps to keep it closed. Anyway, so the Minipolis and many other of Storr's texts were produced in the small size. The size was both portable and easily concealed, and Storr often used false addresses or names, publishers' names from France, or in the case of the Minipolis, no location at all. And it could be printed, stamped on afterwards, either as Cologne or Geneva, depending on perhaps the destination of the text. Anyway, all of this was meant to evade the French censorship regime, a system that, while far from airtight, carried severe consequences for those caught with heretical texts, and especially those originating from Geneva. So out of all of this, and as Alain Dubois, an historian who works especially on Jacob Storr, he asserts that Storr was a commercially successful publisher whose catalog reveals a publisher, a man who was very actively supporting the Calvinist cause far beyond the walls of Geneva. As to his decision to print a revised version of the Minipolis Florum, it may be impossible to establish the exact reasoning, but he must have seen it as a commercially viable production, a belief borne out by the multiple print runs that the text enjoyed. Moreover, commonplace books weren't foreign to the Calvinist market, and they provided valuable access to the sometimes tricky world of patristic authority for Calvinists. The most significant example here is the Bibliotheca Studii Theologici, created by Jean Crespin. It's important here because not only did Storr work with Crespin when he first moved to Geneva, but the text was also printed multiple times in Geneva and elsewhere, not only by Crespin himself, but by others after his death. The Minipolis Florum, meanwhile, could easily have come to Storr's attention through his connections with Lyon, where his proximate source, Thibaut Payen's edition, was printed. And perhaps what interested Storr with this Lyonnais text was his acceptance as a Catholic work, and therefore a discreet way to possibly evade the censors. Payen's text also provided Storr with an important editorial approach to the Minipolis, since Payen passed on the precedent to allow significant and explicit changes to the text by adding quotations and topics and stuff like that. Storr embraced this editorial agency, following in Payen's steps by adding new quotations, entirely new topics, and where Payen used asterisks to mark his quotations. Let's see, jumping. Yeah, so you can see here asterisks to mark new quotations. Well, I guess that's something that he introduced partway through, which makes Payen's edition, it sort of threw the cross-referencing system a little bit out of whack for the earliest topics. Anyway, So whereas Payen used asterisk, Stoer used daggers, although often Stoer, when he replaced quotations, he placed them within the existing system of alphabetization rather than adding them separate with daggers, I guess making the overall process more discrete and it's difficult to really trace. Stoer also added new authors to draw from, a process that may reflect simply the availability of new sources, such as Socrates of Constantinople, which I think was newly available in Latin around this time, or an effort to introduce to the text an author esteemed by Calvinists who had hitherto been absent, such as Irenaeus, who Calvin especially liked, not only as an example of anti-Nicene theology, but also because of his associations with martyrdom. Of course, Stoer could and did also leave topics untouched, which, assuming that the editor's eye passed consistently over the whole text, must itself be seen as an act of editorial choice, the choice to do nothing. Altogether, the different methods of altering the text are illustrated well in the lemmata contained in Volter's list. For instance, with Confessio or Maria, topics linked to Catholic practices that were rejected by Calvinists, Stoer was concerned with removing quotations and replacing others covertly within the alphabetized system. In the case of Eucharistia, a topic whose details and definition divided Catholics from Calvinists, but also Calvinists from other Protestant groups, there is more overt change through his use of daggers to indicate new quotations. This is similar to the changes that Stoer made to the topic Connubium, in which he removed the most misogynistic and anti-marital quotations, in which, especially when taken together with his newly created lemma Adulterium, shows a greater esteem for marriage while also firmly rejecting extramarital sexuality. This would have provided greater pastoral value, along with passages to be used to articulate the perceived differences, more so than any real differences between sexual morality between the faiths. And while this may support the idea of a Protestant rehabilitation of marriage, as David Davrez pointed out, Catholic preachers themselves have been extolling the goods of marriage since at least the 13th century. As a result, Stoer's version of Connubium may also have been more useful to Catholic homiletics than Thomas of Ireland's original version, in the sense that he could more easily have preached on the good of marriage without having these misogynistic texts within Connubium, although it still existed in Molière, but that's a topic for another time. Anyway, or I guess a previous time since I've already looked at it. And finally, in the case of Antichristus, Stoer replaced every quotation, retaining the alphabetized organization, but adding daggers to every letter as well. Here, Stoer gathered a collection of quotations that reflects both the anti-papal polemic and the apocalyptic urgency that was so prevalent at the time. Altogether, then, these editorial changes reveal a carefully considered and purposeful approach to revising the Manipulus Florum, an approach that allows Stoer to create a text that serviced the pastoral and the polemical needs of Calvinist ministers, with numerous passages taken from different authorities, passages that could be cited on their own or used as a guide to further reading or simply for inspiration or ideas. And turning now to Ecclesia, we will see that many of the same editorial approaches were at work and to the same end. Before getting into the changes that Stoer made to Ecclesia, though, it's important to turn first to Payen's edition. For in the case of this topic, not only did Payen introduce the idea of adding new quotations, but also the idea that those quotations chosen could reflect the religious conflict of the time. The greater part of Ecclesia, as it appeared in both Payen's and Stoer's version, was composed of quotations found in the earliest manuscript versions. Thomas of Ireland's lemma contained 23 quotations, to which Payen added 6 and Stoer 5, although Stoer also removed one of Thomas's. Thomas's quotations then remained relevant both to Catholic and Calvinist readers and continued to appeal to their understandings of the Church. There is, for instance, Ecclesia A and B, both from Augustine, which talk about the social bonds and the universality of the Church, respectively. It's maybe too long of a passage to read very quickly, but I'm going to move on anyway. There's also Ecclesia M, which, by comparing the riches of the Church to the poverty of some of its members, would have resonated with both confessions' programs of ecclesiastical reform, as well as Protestant anti-clericalism. Or finally, Ecclesia P, which sees Bernard referring to the church as the bride of Christ, a popular metaphor in both Catholic and Huguenot homiletics. The form of ecclesia as it existed in the 14th century, therefore, still held value to Catholics and Protestants in the 16th and 17th centuries, providing authoritative quotations to help explain both the place of the church in the world and the relationship between the church and God. That value notwithstanding, both Payen and Stoer added a small handful of new quotations each that spoke more specifically to the religious atmosphere of their era. For Payen, who was working in Lyon during the rise of Protestantism and the outbreak of the wars of religion, the dangers of schism would have been particularly pertinent, especially to someone in an industry that saw so many people convert to Protestantism, at least for a while. The quotations that he added reflect such concern. For instance, in two quotations that he added by Augustine, these passages speak to the dangers and divisions confronting the Catholic Church by stating, quote, the church now prays for all people, and yet is not heard on behalf of all of them. And that, quote, the church is like a lily among thorns, with where good and evil are all mixed together. Similarly, Payen added quotations emphasizing the necessity of unity, such as one from Gregory, stating that, quote, the church is the unity of believers as members of one body, and one from Bernard that explains that the church designates a unified multitude. This one here. These quotations, and the others added by Payen, are consistent with Thomas of Ireland's version, and do not therefore radically alter the overall feel of the topic. Nonetheless, the unifying theme of these editions, namely the concern over divisions within the church and the emphasis on unity, reflect his context of being in France during the Wars of Religion. All of this was taken by Stoer as he established his version of the text. The principle of adding quotations that reflect their current confessional struggle, and ultimately Payen's quotations themselves. That is, in Stoer's version of Ecclesia, and all of these images that I've shown so far are actually out of Payen's edition and not out of, or out of Stoer's edition, not out of Payen's. Stoer took all of Payen's additions and transmitted them, an example of how the authorities and ideas were shared and utilized by both sides. So turning finally to Stoer's version of Ecclesia, we find a lemma that reproduces in large part what was inherited from Payen, but also one that, thanks to its additional quotations, has its own unique voice. It is not difficult to see how Payen's version retained relevance to Stoer in his Calvinist market. After all, the issues of religious unity and division were equally important to them. Yet, as relevant as those inherited quotations remain to the Calvinist cause, it is the ones that Stoer himself added that really reflect the conditions in which the text was produced and the conditions in which it was likely employed. And it is therefore these quotations that help to reorient the overall message to one that seems to speak to the circumstances of French Calvinists, while also reinforcing existing themes within the lemma. In terms of reinforcing themes, Stoer added a quotation from Chrysostom, explaining that the church is composed of the godly and the faithful, while decrying disputes, divisions, and pridefulness. And as a way to condemn the corruption and worldliness of the Catholic Church, he adds a quotation from Sulpicius Severus that explains, quote, that the church is not built of gold, but can be destroyed by it. Through the additions of these quotations, Stoer is reiterating ideas that were already present in Ecclesia. But in doing so, he was also assenting to their importance to Calvinists and providing further authorities through which to decry their perceived Catholic errors. The first quotation that Stoer added, meanwhile, which was placed before Ecclesia A, and which comes from Irenaeus's Against Heresies, recalls a Protestant view of the singular importance of Scripture to define doctrine, a recurrent theme in Huguenot sermons, stating that, quote, while the church is scattered throughout the world, the pillar and the support of the church is the gospel and the spirit of life. This passage may also have had special significance to the Huguenot church, positing the ability and authority of Scripture to ensure doctrinal integrity among the many Huguenot congregations themselves scattered non-hierarchically across France. As an aside, Huguenots actually destroyed Irenaeus' tomb and relics in Lyon in 1562 during a bout of iconoclasm. But it was his words that were important anyway, not his bones. Towards the end of the lemma, Sore added a quotation from Socrates of Constantinople that suggests that the afflictions that Huguenots faced at the hands of the Catholic Church are a sign of the illegitimacy of the papacy, since, quote, the Orthodox Church is not in the habit of persecuting men. This is an important addition because persecution played such a central part of the Huguenot experience in the formation of Huguenot confessional identity. Persecution and affliction were common themes of Huguenot sermons, used as a way to insist upon greater piety, but also an important means to confirm their belief in being God's true church. It was a way to establish a genealogy that linked them to God's chosen people of earlier eras, who had also suffered numerous afflictions, namely the early church or ancient Israel. And Huguenot preachers focused on specific biblical imagery that emphasized suffering and faith, especially the Psalms, ensuring that their understanding of the true church cohered with their current situation, in effect giving persecution a positive interpretation by linking it to God's providence through historical precedents. A similar situation exists for the final of Storer's editions to be discussed, a quotation from Gregory Nazianzus, which asks, "Where are those who reproach us for our poverty and insolently boast of their own might, who define the church by its magnitude and scorn a small flock?" For similar to embracing persecution as an integral part of the group identity, Huguenot numerical inferiority also became a key component of how they defined themselves and how they framed their arguments about the legitimacy of their church. The initial missionary movements organized by Calvin had naturally wanted to win all of France for the Reformed faith, and so being a minority did not initially influence their self-understanding. However, through the wars of religion and after events such as the St. Bartholomew Day massacre, their minority status became an established condition, so that by the Edict of Nantes in 1598 and through the 17th century, being a small and exclusive church became an important part of their identity and was used to reaffirm their status of being the true church. So they were, at the outbreak of the wars of religion, the most optimistic numbers say that they made up between a tenth and a fifth of the French population, and very quickly they dropped down to about 5% of the population and never got much higher than that. So they were about a million people out of a population of 20 million. So it is in that spirit that Huguenot ministers appeal to gospel passages such as Luke 12:32, say, "Do not be afraid, little flock," to refer to the Huguenot church as God's petit troupeau, with an emphasis on the petit. Or Matthew 18:20, "For where two or three are assembled in my name, there I am with them," to use the two or three as a means to legitimize the Huguenot small numbers. By doing this, they are able to link their church, again, to earlier eras, to the apostolic church and to ancient Jews, who likewise were small communities surrounded by multitudes of non-believers. And as a result, their small numbers became a sign of their special relationship with God, again, a positive sign that distinguished them from the Catholic majority around them. By adding quotations such as these to the lemma, therefore, Storer made ecclesia more suitable for Huguenot use. Without them, they would have still contained many useful references for Calvinist pastors and polemicists, since it would have provided support for many parts of how the Calvinist church was conceived of as an entity and how it existed in relationship to God. But with them, Storer's ecclesia provided a more complete picture of the Calvinist perspective, and more precisely, reflects the particular circumstances of Calvinists in France. After all, not only does the lemma provide support for claims of papal corruption or the importance of scripture, but it also appeals to the particularly Huguenot concerns rooted in their state of being an often persecuted minority in France. Altogether, then, Storer's version of ecclesia provided a well-rounded selection of passages in support of Huguenot confessional identity, passages that helped to make sense of their situation, and passages that helped them to define themselves in opposition to the Catholic Church. So knowing the nature of the Genevan printing industry at the turn of the 17th century, and knowing the net result of Storer's editorial work, it is evident that Huguenots were an ideal market for his Manipulus Florum and must have been one of his primary targets. The difficult part, though, is finding definitive cases of that reception and usage. I mean, there's many reasons for this. I mean, in the first place, there aren't many library inventories, whether private or ecclesiastical, that we can look through. And extant sermons, which in theory would be a good source to look for this type of reception, the sermons only come from a very select number of ministers. Say, for a couple examples, extant Huguenot sermons are printed sermons, and they come from the leading pastors of the day, men who ministered to the most important congregations in the largest towns and cities, or who taught at leading Huguenot academies. As a result, they had considerable resources with which to construct their sermons and other tracts. Jean Daae, for instance, a pastor in Paris for over four decades, had an extensive church library that included multiple volumes from the church fathers and medieval writers, pagan authors, as well as, that doesn't matter, it's, as well as contemporary Catholics and Protestants, and this would have been in addition to his own personal library. Daae then represents the elite of Huguenot ministers for whom the manipulus would not have been as necessary due to the resources at their disposal, except perhaps as a schoolbook or as a guide to further reading. It is with the lesser-known ministers, then, which is to say nothing about an elite but non-clerical market, that the greatest value of Storer's text may be found, and yet there is no record of their sermons or other work that survives. Because of that, an alternative approach is to find common themes between extant texts from the elite ministers and from Storer's text, some of which I've mentioned already, so as to demonstrate a common framework of ideas between the two. And in doing so, it reveals that there's a great deal of overlap in terms of images and ideas. This is the case with the image of the church as the bride of Christ, which is a very common image to be employed in Catholic and Protestant sermons for hundreds of years. It was an image that was used to assert the indissoluble relationship between the Huguenot church and God, and to provide a contrast between the Huguenot church as the faithful bride and the Catholic church as a lascivious adulteress, and often as a whore of Babylon. This is also seen in the phrasing and imagery used to define the church in other ways. A telling example is a sermon of Matthew 18:20, where two or three are assembled in my name, which was preached by Pierre Dumoulin, a minister who served both Paris and Sedan at different times. Not surprisingly, the sermon shows similarities in word choice to the corporal definitions of the church and emphasis on unity, I found in the quotations added by Soren Payen and also in Thomas's original quotations, where Dumoulin says that the church is an assembly of faithful in one body. Demonstrating more significant similarities, though, Dumoulin also uses themes akin to those specifically added by Storer to describe the persecution and small numbers of the Huguenot church. He explains that, quote, "Our adversaries, seeing truly our weakness and our small number, speak about us with great contempt." However, he counters that, quote, "Even when the Church of Israel was in bloom, such as in the time of David and Solomon, the people of Israel were as though nothing compared to the great pagan empires in the rest of the world." So using both historical example and scriptural evidence, Dumoulin is able to conclude that, quote, "It is a great abuse to take multitude as the mark of the true church." Similar themes are seen in sermons of other ministers too, such as the Saumurois pastor Moïse Amiraux, or the aforementioned Jean Daae, who explains that, quote, "In comparison to this large population with whom we live, we are like a small island in the middle of the ocean, battered from all sides by an infinitely large sea. But what others take as an unpleasant mark, we have as an argument for our happiness, since it is to the petit troupeau that the Son of God sends his consolations." What this shows, then, is that although the use of Storer's manipulus florum cannot be definitively established in these examples, there's a clear similarity in the imagery and the arguments made. Seen this way, Storer's text coheres very well ideologically with what existed in these Huguenot sermons and would have been a useful resource, whether to mine for ideas, direct quotations, as a guide to further reading, or as exegetical inspiration. And this would have been the case especially for academy students and lesser-known or itinerant ministers who shared an intellectual and theological world with their more elite colleagues, but who didn't share the same access to resources. Altogether, then, considering the multiple print runs that the text enjoyed and the thematic similarities that align so closely to the Huguenot situation, it seems clear that Storer's version of the Manipulus Florum represents an editorial impetus thoroughly informed not only by Calvinist concerns, but by the needs of French Calvinists in particular. By examining the quotations contained in Jakob Stor's version of the Lemma Ecclesia, then, we can see how, through his editorial work, he fashioned a version of the Miblis Florum that, in the words of Anne Moss, was, quote, suitably adapted, quote, unquote, to the Protestant cause. Following the trail of Bernard Wolter's contempt for the Calvinist version, we find Ecclesia as a prime example of how Stor brought the text into the confessional era, and how it was revised to reflect key components of Huguenot confessional identity, whether their minority status, the persecution that they faced, or their opposition to the Catholic Church. Yet, the additive nature of Stor's changes to Ecclesia reveal another important element of the era, the ideological overlap that existed between confessions. These weren't two discrete and antithetical systems, but rather they shared a common repertoire of imagery and authority that, among other things, allowed their respective arguments and accusations to be familiar and intelligible to all parties. Therefore, Stor's text demonstrates through these characteristics important information about its functionality and about the ideological context of the era, where there was both a powerful impetus to establish points of differentiation between rival faiths, but also revealing the underlying similarities that inform their opposing positions. It is within this complex of ideas and images that Stor's Manipulus Forum participates, a situation that is reflected especially clearly in the topic Ecclesia. Thank you.